Hello there, this is Mark Bauerlein for another conversation. Today we have Adeline Allen. Adeline Allen is Associate Professor of Law at Trinity International University, which is in Southern California. She is an expert in areas of defamation, technology, the sharing economy, platforms. Our topic today, though, is a different one. It is based on an article published by her last year in the Harvard Journal of Law and Public Policy entitled, quote, "Surrogacy and Limitations to Freedom of Contract Toward Being More Fully Human." So the topic there is surrogacy. Welcome, Professor Allen.
Thank you very much for having me.
Okay, let's just start from real basic questions. What is surrogacy? How is the woman impregnated?
Generally, these days, they use IVF. So it will be the commissioning parents. Sometimes it's the man's sperm and the woman's egg created in a lab, and the embryo is implanted in the, as I like to call her, the birth mother's womb, sometimes called the surrogate mother's womb. Now, that doesn't have to be the case. You might have a same-sex couple who wants the baby as the commissioning parents. You might have a single person. Obviously, then we're missing one of the two components to make an embryo. So now we're talking about perhaps a donor egg or a donor sperm or some combination thereof. It gets pretty messy.
And with the same-sex couple, so the birth mother is the mother. It's her egg.
That can be the case if we have two women who are the commissioning parents. That can be the case, sure.
Okay, and so then, I mean, this is a financial arrangement. Is it? I mean, how does the whole you refer in your essay to? I think you call it the surrogate industry, and. How does this work? I mean, is this happening mostly in the United States? Is it an international phenomenon? This, I mean, you talk about, you know, we can talk about this kind of arrangement going all the way back to the ancient times. But in this technological version that you're referring to, when did this start? It had to be the past couple decades?
Yeah, the rise of IVF started the what I focused on, gestational surrogacy. And as you can understand, people feel a lot more comfortable with that versus the traditional surrogacy. Way back, you actually have intercourse between the man and the mother who's supposed to carry this baby. But then we moved on to we can use the sperm to be inseminated. So at least there's no intercourse. But since IVF, if we can have the embryo using that choice sperm and that choice egg, things started taking off. Perhaps as just, a mark on the road, the first big surrogacy case in the United States was the late 80s, the Baby M case in New Jersey, although that was still traditional surrogacy with artificial insemination by the intended or the commissioning father. And then in California, a few years later, in the early 90s, we've got Johnson v. Calford, and that was gestational surrogacy. But yes, it's big business. It's an international thing. Although in the United States, we do a lot of it. These numbers are now a couple years old, but it was a $6 billion global industry when I wrote this, or at least was doing research, and $4 billion in terms of an industry in our country alone. We're quite the destination. It has to do with we don't have a national or a federal law governing surrogacy. And on a state level, each state does its own thing. It's a patchwork of laws, you can call it that way. And so we attract commissioning parents from all over the world, especially if they come from a country where surrogacy has been banned.
So these mothers can be recruited from abroad, brought here, paid to carry the child, and then they go home.
That can happen. It's a little messier. I happen to focus on just what was going on in our country with US citizens as the
Okay.
birth mothers. But yes, that can happen. If we're talking about demographics, who are these women who are signing up? They sign their name on the line in the contract to be birth mothers. They tend to be poorer than the commissioning parents, and perhaps that's not surprising. Surrogacy costs money, a lot of money. And by the way, if you can't afford it, it's between 90 to 150,000 if you want to do surrogacy in the United States.
And how much does the mother who carries the term, how much does she typically get paid?
In the United States, 20,000 probably is the lower end, and it goes all the way up to 30, 35, 40-ish. Yes, I was just driving to work the other day. This was maybe 2 months ago, and it was kind of call-in radio show in the morning for commuters. And here in Southern California, where I live and work, and the question of the day was, "Hey, have you done surrogacy? How is it for you?" And these numbers tend to match the callers who were calling into the radio station that morning.
And I mean, are there some women who do this over and over and over again for the money?
There are, and in fact, the narrative, what's being said by these women is they really want to help. And of course that's true, but if you look at the numbers, only about 2% of surrogates or birth mothers are there for purely altruistic reasons. Meaning they want to help, yes, they want to help this couple or this person have the baby, and that's fulfilling, but of course they also appreciate getting paid. I didn't mention, and I should, when they get paid, say 20 to 40,000 for this, which is only a portion of what the commissioning parents would have to pay. The rest of the money go to would go to the doctors, the lawyers, the broker, the system.
And I imagine when you get a mother who conducts one case successfully, they want her again, right? I mean, it seems like they have a farm team here that they can call upon at all times.
Yes, and in fact, they can. These women can be paid more if they've been a veteran surrogate. She's proven herself. We know she's healthy, and the last one was successful.
And the price goes up.
And the price can go up for her, right?
Yes.
Well, and perhaps for the commissioning parents, if you've got a better, from their eyes, it's a better carrier. And so that's a very reductionistic term for the birth mother.
But let's be honest, right? I mean, that's her role is to carry the infant to birth and then hand it over.
Right, under these contracts, that's exactly what she's supposed to do, which is.
What are some of the terms of the contract that she signs?
Well, we talked about payments, and we talked about, and let me just say one more thing about kind of this picture that we have in our mind of her. I think it's interesting that about four, or it's estimated 40 to 50% of these birth mothers are military wives. They don't make that much money. They're trying to make a little more money on the side, and they realize, well, my husband's away on deployment. I'm home with my kids. What can I do to make more money? Well, I have my body. I can put it to work by carrying this baby for another person or some other couple. But that's interesting. And you were asking, what are some terms? Well, a lot of times the contract would call this woman made in the image of God, and we would call her in the contract a gestational carrier.
That's the legal term for her. She's the gestational carrier.
Carrier, yes. And I've read and seen interviews of these birth mothers later saying, I felt like I was a number, I wasn't a person. And here I have to mention the expert in the field, and I cite her a lot. I really admire her, Jennifer Lall over at the Center for Bioethics. She has mentioned that women are not breeders, but we end up making them breeders. Jennifer Lall's point, and she has many good points, but here's one. How do we know from looking at the contract that we don't care about these birth mothers as whole persons? Well, if we look at the contract, it defines and puts boundaries on what these women can and cannot do, down to whether they can have sexual intercourse if they're married and to their husbands, but what they can eat, what they cannot eat. So this is all about what they're doing for the commissioning parents, as opposed to who they are as whole people. I guess that's just a glimpse of these contracts.
Right. And I imagine the future parents, the couple that is going to raise the child, that they want to control what's going to happen to that child during those 9 months, down to everything, every behavior of the mother. Now, what if the are there cases in which the gestational carrier starts getting attached to this life growing inside her?
Yes, and not surprisingly, quite a few of them, if not more, get attached. There's the science end of things, and the field is growing: epigenetics, fetal origins, what happens in the womb. And while the baby is his own person, he is in the womb, in the birth mother's womb, and they're one and yet not one. There's the sweep of the body, one scientist put it that way, what the mother eats, the emotions she goes through. Any woman who's been pregnant knows about this. The midwife or the doctor would say, careful with stress, careful with what you eat. Don't eat raw fish, for example. Here in the United States, they say don't drink, right? Because the baby gets all of this. The baby is experiencing what you're experiencing. So not surprisingly, there's been even quite a few lawsuits. When the mother gives birth, right, the baby's whisked away. There's one heartbreaking account where the birth mother says, I didn't even know whether the baby was a boy or a girl, and I can't stop thinking about that baby that this birth mother has never met, not even know, was that a boy or a girl? And there's that deep sense of loss. And that's actually my entrance to the issue. I have been teaching the surrogacy cases because they're in my casebook to my first-year law students for years. And really, I didn't have a position one way or the other. I could see it both ways. And here, shout out to my Catholic brothers and sisters. What wonderful teaching that you guys have. The theology of the body is developed. The catechism is clear about no surrogacy. But I'm evangelical, and growing up in the evangelical church, it's just not mentioned. It's silence. So I didn't have a position. I didn't know. Then I became pregnant, had my first, and my midwives were good midwives. And at birth, they were helping me to nurse the child and do skin-to-skin bonding, this, that, and the other. And then it dawned on me that if all this stuff matters, what the midwives were telling me to do, then at best, it's incoherent, this whole surrogacy business, that the baby's just a thing that you can pass around. Doesn't matter who the birth mother is. And at worst, it's a huge, huge lie. It's deceitful, it's injurious to baby and birth mother.
Do gestational carriers ever get asked by the adoptive couple to remain involved, to nurse the baby? They don't want the complication. They want separation. Yes or no?
I think in the rare case, you might see, okay, why don't you nurse the baby a little bit? But my understanding is the majority of cases, let's not have that bonding. Let's not have breastfeeding because then the separation is that much harder for everybody. Although for the baby, it's hard to say. Not having that separation is rough, and having separation is rough. Meaning for the baby, not being breastfed, not having bonded with that birth mother is very hard, might have some lifelong consequences and problems. But then if you do separate the baby later, that's also very much problematic. It's a lose-lose for the baby.
If so, can you have a contract when the gestational carrier, it was her egg that was that was used? Let's say, a same sex, a gay male same sex couple just used one of the sperm of one of them, and then her egg, she can't, if she signs that contract, that's it. It doesn't matter. The biological connection, that doesn't matter. She waives all of her rights. Basically, she's given up the child to adoption, in, I guess, in so many words.
Right, so that's traditional surrogacy when her child is her genetic and gestational child. And that's much more problematic in the law. The law is much harder on that. Basically, you're giving up your child for adoption before you get pregnant. And that's very rare, very hard to do. What's going on these days is 90, at least, oh, I don't know, 98% gestational surrogacy. And because that, I think we are missing in the law. We're very confused in the law as to what gestational tie means to the child and what it means to be human. Is it true that the lack of genetic tie to the birth mother, so only the gestational tie, is it true that that's not important? Is it true that she is not the child's biological mother? If what she is the gestational mother only.
The word carrier, sort of in part, you're a carrier. There's just there's you're just carrying that life inside you for a while, and you didn't really produce it. It was put inside you. I think that's, yeah, as you put it earlier, it's reductive. It minimizes, I mean, deliberately, it minimizes the experience of a pregnant mother here. And that's the point, right? We don't want to emphasize that experience that she is having. It has to be instrumentalized and utilitarianized so that things are simple. It's just a contractual thing.
Exactly. Because language matters, because that frames what's going on, because that has to do with how we perceive reality. That's exactly why she's called the gestational carrier. In fact, there's the old sitcom Friends from the 1990s. One of the characters, Phoebe, got pregnant as a gestational mother for, oh, it was messy. I think it was her half brother and the half brother's wife. Their embryo implanted in her, and her line is, "I'm just the oven, it's their bun."
Adeline, don't you hate Hollywood?
Yeah. And I live right here in the backyard.
Friends did a lot of damage to millennials, I think. So how common is this now? You mentioned some financial numbers. Did you have absolute numbers in how common this is in the United States, at least?
Oh boy, I don't right off the top of my head. I'm sorry, but it's becoming more common. And I think what's telling is I'm seeing this kind of trickle down effect. Speaking of Hollywood, more and more celebrities are doing this, and it gets written up about. And then because it's so expensive to do it in the United States, if you want to go cheap, you got to go out of the United States. And in some countries, it's been made illegal, but of some other countries, you can still do it. Then the upper middle class start doing it, and there's this trickle down effect. And of course, it's more than uncomfortable that the birth mothers, again, tend to be those who are of the lower socioeconomic class than the counterparts, the commissioning parents. But yeah, more and more celebrities are doing it. I see it all the time in the news. And the story stuck at your heartstrings. And I want to be mindful of that. I hope I was mindful of that. I hope that came through in my article. Now, the pain of infertility is real.
But why not adopt then? I mean, can't you adopt very, I mean, infants 1 month old?
Yeah, they can. But these people, and I get it, they want a child of their own genetic makeup. And that desire is built into us. That's written in our being. So that's what they want. I mean, really, when Baby M again is a traditional surrogacy case from the late 80s, but in that case, you'll see that the commissioning father, let's say his parents, it was written up, were survivors of the Holocaust, and he was the only what person left in the line. So it makes sense that they want to continue that gene, right? I get it. This is tender issue. These are tender issues. We're talking about parents who have tried for many years sometimes, and they cannot have a child. My favorite celebrity that's done surrogacy, perhaps, is Jimmy Fallon. Sweet guy. I don't know him. I just watch him on YouTube sometimes. Sweet guy. And he and his wife really struggled with infertility. I think it was 5 years, he said, for 5 years. And for 5 years, he said, I had to go to work and be funny every day, even though we were very sad. And that's just such a sad story. And that's where the stories start and end. I think you rarely hear the gestational or the birth mother side unless there's a big lawsuit and it's very messy.
I imagine the contracts have, confidentiality elements that keep that part quiet, yes?
Yes, except then if something gets very messy, say this happens quite a bit, right? With IVF, and then there's more than one infant in the womb, there might be something wrong. And then the commissioning parents say, well, never mind. We've got that clause in there that if we want to back out, you have to abort. This is part of the language. Again, the child is a commodity, and we think of the child and the woman as raw material, right? This is an artifice. So we get to say you exist and you don't exist. We commission you into being, and then we decommission you into from being. So, but at this point, a lot of times the birth mother would say, "I can't do it. I am attached to the child who's growing in my womb." So then a lawsuit happens.
And she doesn't have money for a lawyer, does she?
No, and thank God for some pro bono lawyers who would step up sometimes.
Yeah. And this is one reason why you say in your article that the ordinary rules of consent really aren't quite the right basis for this contract. I mean, consent is crucial to all contractual law, but this one is a little more complicated. Why is that?
Our society is so used to thinking of consent as the magic ingredient. Hey, that was consensual. All's okay. And yet, we know instinctively, and it's enshrined in the law, that not everything is up for consent, even in the realm of contracts. I don't get to say, hey, I really don't like so and so. Why don't I hire you, contract killer, to take out so and so? If the contract killer and I have consented to that arrangement, it doesn't make it okay. Perhaps closer to home is I don't get to enter into a contract, even with my own consent, to enter into slavery. So I think the harder question, though, is surrogacy. But and we can spend a lot of time talking about this, but I make the argument, I submit that with regard to gestating a human being and all its implications, all the bonding that we know about and what we don't know about, the very private realm of pregnancy for the woman, that should not be up for the market. And if we do that, we're dehumanizing, making a commodity out of the woman and the child. There's a lot of risks that we know when we put the mother through this, and for the child, some risk I'll just mentioned. Increased risk of gestational diabetes for the birth mother, increased risk of stroke, multiple gestation, because we use IVF, long-term hospitalization, increase in C-section, and one One birth mother died in 2015. She was 34 years old when she was carrying twins for this couple from Spain. The twins died with her. They were, I think, a day away from their scheduled C-section. She and her husband had three boys of their own. So she left this family, three boys, now motherless, and the husband is a widower. That's just some risk. There's drugs involved for IVF and implantation. That's dangerous to the mother, the birth mother. Use of the foreign egg when it's not her egg, when we're talking about gestational surrogacy, it's not her egg. Then we've got increased risk of hypertension and preeclampsia. After birth, not being able to breastfeed is harder for that birth mother to recover and heal. Increased risk of hemorrhage, of heart disease, of diabetes. And if she can't breastfeed, because according to the contract, she's not allowed to, you're supposed to hand the baby over, then she's barred from long-term, or I guess the benefit of breastfeeding long-term, like decreased risk of breast cancer, cervical cancer, uterine cancer, and osteoporosis. And of course, I mentioned that risk of a sense of deep loss after the baby's born. And that's just, I basically, so far, I've mostly covered the birth mother. You mentioned consent not being the right framework for this. We talked all about the commissioning parents and a mother, and so much of this affects the child in negative ways. How about his consent? Totally not in here. I was presenting this research to a group of scholars at the James Madison program at Princeton University, where I was a visiting fellow that year. And somebody said, but isn't it true that none of us consented to being born? And that's absolutely true. And I owe this particular answer to one of the scholars there, Matt Frank. He heard this from somebody who was born due to rape. I think that was the story. But I don't know the name of this person to whom I owe this quote. Matt Frank heard about it from her. So anyway, she said it's not inconsistent to be happy, to be grateful that you exist, and at the same time mourn because the circumstances of your birth were injurious to you. And I thought that was true.
Professor Allen, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.